Good morning, fine people, and welcome to another exciting, gripping episode of what one might call The Naked Englishman. And if you did call it that, you're on the right place. I should tell you, it is the 14th today. You all right, puss? You still breathing? Yes. It's the 14th of May, 2025, and it's at some point in the morning, probably 7:30, something like that. We had a bit of a funny thing yesterday. It's actually 7:40. Bloody hell. There was this squealing outside. We were all sitting having a chat. Somebody popped round. A chap who gave me the reverse osmosis water machine. Anyway, we were chatting away, minding our own business. I'm just looking for my little jumperette. And we heard all this squealing. We thought, somebody sounds like they're abusing an animal. Peered outside, on the pavement, almost opposite the house, on the other side of the road, obviously, opposite, was that some people gathered round an animal, looked like a dog, was a dog. Turned out the dog had fallen out of the third-story window. Ground, first and second? Yeah, the second story window of a house opposite, and clearly had hurt itself, whether it had broken its legs or, you know, back or something. Anyway, it was squealing terribly. At first I thought it was, you know, at one animal against another animal and they were fighting or whatever.
Maybe been run over.
But it was clear. Anyway, people had gathered very quickly around, and the owner, of course, they were all a bit distraught and trying to get a vet. And take it to the vet, and eventually a car came and they drove off. But that was quite extraordinary, wasn't it?
It seems like the people in the basement apartment had seen it fall, came running out because they were the first, barefoot and everything.
And they seemed to know what to do, which was good. And we watched a little bit, not very much, because the last thing when you're in this sort of thing, you don't need gawpers gawping from across the road. Had it been next door or whatever, we would have obviously intervened.
At first we were gawping out of shock, and then we were gawping just to see and waiting to see if there's anything they needed us to do, but they all had it in hand.
So. Yes, well, they had it in hand, so we... But yes, poor little animal, but, stupid... the hot weather, you see, somebody had opened their window quite wide without any barrier or thought that the dog might leap out or fall out.
Even though the dog stands there yapping at that window and hanging out of it anyway all day.
So, yeah, you know. It may have learnt its lesson.
Well, it's not just the dog, it's the owner.
Yeah. No, it is a shame. Anyway, hopefully it's all fixed and maybe we'll see evidence of that.
Touch wood.
In the future. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring that to you. You all right down there? Would you like another drink, or you've still got yours? Are you still got half yours? Lovely jubbly. I'm just going to put my... Yesterday was a funny day. It was cooler in the evening. And I have been switching between shorts and long trousers. And of course, what one has to try and do is to keep switching the old keys from pocket to pocket. Because I don't want to lock myself out of the house inadvertently if I go out. Not that I... intend to, but you never know what could happen in the next half hour, as they say. So that's all good. Well, I don't know whether it's good. Anyway, I shall leave these long trousers ready for putting on a bit later on if the weather turns. And at the moment, you never quite know whether it's going to turn or not. I watched... Somebody sent me a video yesterday... of a chap, I can't remember his name, I think it's Anthony Burgess or somebody. I've had him on my show, and he starts off his video saying, these chemtrails is absolute bollocks, there's no such thing. Now, he normally deals in 5G, and he's a very nice chap, and he seems to be very authoritative. But somewhere along the line, he's got sort of a bit confused, I believe, because we know so many people, I've talked to so many people, and pilots... who's instructed us and told us, genuinely, from all sorts of different, you know, different people, that these are definitely chemtrails. And we know it because of all the patents that have been filed we know what they're doing, the UK government has admitted it and various things. And this chap released this video to say it was all rubbish. I mean, even Katie Hopkins put a video out the other day saying, when she showed the sky that she'd walked out into wherever she happened to be, and saying, there is no way you can tell me this is normal. We do have memories, and if they think that the Mandela effect is what's telling us that these skies have always been crisscrossed with bloody, what do you call it, noughts and crosses, the chemtrails, and they've got another thing coming. I mean, they really are trying to push this normalising what they're doing to the skies. And as my pilot friend said, he says, you know, condensation trails only happen at, I can't remember what it is, 30, 40,000 feet. The temperature has to be at a certain thing, and the petrol fumes create this condensation, or the heat of the engine creates this, and then it disappears within 10 to 20 seconds, and it's gone. He said, but these chemtrails that we see in the sky, they are much lower. They're like 10,000 feet. He says, you don't get that condensation at that level. He's flown commercial jets and knows what he's talking about. And this chapter, come on, anyway, you know, it was laughable. And I think more than anything, he has just embarrassed himself, really. He doesn't probably know that, but he... Anyway, so somebody sent that. Every now and again, there are people who are trying to say, oh, it doesn't happen. Now, I'm not saying that everything that you see in the sky is a chemtrail. There could be various different things, but we know it's going on. The sun is out. It's rather nice. I'm just going to go and take a step outside again. See what the wind is doing. It seems quite windy, that's the only thing. Not too windy, not too windy. And yesterday we came out in the lane in the morning and we sat in the sun, because first thing in the morning, I don't get much sun on my house. I get it from about, I don't know, 11:30. Well, 10 o'clock. By 10 o'clock, you can just about get the sun in the garden. And then by 11, you can actually sit in it. But at 7 or 8 or 9, yesterday, about 9 o'clock, we sat out here in the lane at the back of my house. And both Julia has a copy of my book Biggleswick, the editing copy, and I have a copy which I'm red penning, and she was reading it aloud and I was following it, and then we were both going through the text. It was really good having a second person to do it with, so that we could then say, do you think that should be a with or an and, should there be a comma there, or does that just run off? And oh, there's, you know, with two eyes on it and going through it in that way worked really, really well. But and I wish Julia had the time, which she doesn't because of the children, to do more of that. But anyway, we had a guest yesterday. We had two guests, in fact. One chap, the chap Craig, who gave me the reverse osmosis machine. He seems quite happy. Very nice chap. He came round to sort of catch up. He's normally up north, you see, but he was working in this area, and he said, oh, I'm in the area, I'll pop round, just see how you're doing, have a cup of tea and a chat and a catch up. So that was nice. And then Robin Oakey from Ledbury in Herefordshire, he's got a venue called The Barn. He wanted to come down. I thought he was coming down to do a podcast, but I think he just wanted to have a bit of a break, which is fine. But as you know, I'm so busy with this book and interviews and various things. So yesterday I had Mark Devlin interviewed on the show, and that will go out this afternoon. So I've just got to put that together. So that's been quite good. Another chap who came around today, he said, I'm going to lend you a book. It's called How to Read a Book. Not How to Write a Book, How to Read a Book. The Classic Guide to Intelligent Reading. And he was telling me about it. This is a chap who brings us some kindling from time to time, because near him is a woodyard. There's a carpenter, and he does a lot of work, and he throws out some stuff. So, anyway, I thought I'd just read you a little bit about this book, because I thought, well, you know, somebody's written a book on how to read a book, but you need to be able to read the book about how to read a book. It says, How to Read a Book, originally published in 1940, has become a rare phenomenon, a living classic. It's the best and most successful guide to reading comprehension for the general reader, and now has been completely rewritten and updated. Oh, right. You are told about the various levels of reading and how to achieve them, from elementary reading through to systematic skimming and inspectional reading to speed reading. You learn how to pigeonhole a book, x-ray it, extract the author's message, criticise. You're taught the different reading techniques for reading practical books, imaginative literature, plays, poetry, history, science, mathematics, philosophy and social services. Finally, it's not social science, rather. Finally, the authors offer a recommended reading list and supply reading tests. Right, okay. It is an American thing, so one has to bear that in mind. Let's have a look. What's this saying? For reading... Excuse me, something just tickled my throat there. For reading stories, plays and poems. Here we go, let's read a little bit of this. Let's get the light on the page. I always need a bit of light on the page. The parallel rules for reading imaginative literature that were discussed in the last chapter... Oh, maybe we should be... Imaginative literature. I mean, what do they call imaginative literature? Is that fiction? Is that sort of stories? So far, this book has been concerned with only half the reading that most people do. Even that is too liberal an estimate. Probably the greater part of anybody's reading time is spent on newspapers and magazines and on things that have been read in connection with one's job. So far as books are concerned, most of us read more fiction than non-fiction. Furthermore, the non-fiction books, the most popular, are those that, like newspapers and magazines, deal journalistically with matters of contemporary interest. Bear in mind this was written in 1940, although it's been rewritten. We have not deceived you about the rules set forth in the preceding chapters. Before undertaking to discuss them in detail, we'll explain that we would have to limit ourselves to the business of reading serious non-fiction books. To have expounded the rules for reading imaginative and expository literature at the same time would have been confusing. But now we cannot ignore the other types of reading any longer. So, but it seems that most of this is about reading newspapers and reports and forms and non-fiction and things like that. But the bit that really interests me is how to read imaginative literature. So let's see. Before embarking on the task, we want to emphasise one rather strange paradox. The problem of knowing how to read imaginative literature is inherently more difficult than the problem of knowing how to read expository books. That's not how you pronounce it, is it? Expository books. Expository books, is it? Expository. I've not heard that word before. Nevertheless, it seems to be a fact that such skill is more widely possessed than the art of reading science and philosophy, politics, economics and history. How can this be true? It may be, of course, that people deceive themselves about their ability to read novels intelligently. From our teaching experience, we know how tongue-tied people become when they're asked to say what they like about a novel. That they enjoyed it is perfectly clear to them, but they cannot give much an account of their enjoyment or tell what the book contained that caused them pleasure. This might indicate that people can be good readers of fiction without being good critics. We suspect this is at best a half-truth. A critical reading of anything demands upon the fullness of one's apprehension. Those who cannot say what they like about a novel probably have not read it below its most obvious surfaces. However, there is more to the paradox than that. Imaginative literature primarily pleases rather than teaches. It is much easier to be pleased than taught, much harder to know why one is pleased. Beauty is hard to analyse than truth. Yes. Now that, I think, is a very interesting thing, and one can talk about that at great length. I'm not going to, but one can certainly sort of wax lyrical about why something that is beautiful matters and has more impression than something whether it is factually true or not. Because, in a way, beauty or pleasure is really more truthful than cold facts. Something might be true, you know, you might be able to say, well, hot air rises, that may be true, but it leaves you cold. Hot air rises, but the fact of that leaves you cold. Whereas breathing perhaps the beautiful smell of flowers on a walk, or plants, or the bouquet of trees, pleasing you is more truthful, or apparently more truthful, than those facts, and therefore has much more impression upon you. That cold air rises is just, well, so what? But that you can walk into an orchard, say, and smell the blossom, or that you taste the first blackberry of the season, is much more truthful and pleasurable and meaningful than a fact that, you know, a car running at 30 miles an hour could potentially kill you. I mean, you know, this is obvious. But anyway, let's just go a little bit further into this. To make the point clear would require an extensive analyst of aesthetic appreciation. We cannot undertake that here. We can, however, give you some advice on how to read imaginative literature. We'll proceed first by the way of negation, stating the obvious don'ts instead of the constructive rules. And then we'll proceed to the way of analogy. How do you say it?
Analogy,
thank you. See, once you get the word wrong in your head, you can't say it. Analogy.
Once you say it a few too many times, even I can't get it.
There you go. See, I blind Julia with it, as I'm trying to reach for the word that I know how to say, but for some reason I'm looking at analogy, and I think that's not right.
Not quite.
Anyway, a way of analogy, briefly translating the rules of reading non-fiction into the equivalent of reading fiction. Finally, in the next chapter, we will proceed to examine the problems of reading specific types of imaginative literature, namely plays, lyrics, poems, and so and so. Okay, so I'm just going to quickly, because time is of the essence, and I've given you 18 minutes, but what does it say for not, how not to read imaginative literature? So I'm just going to try and... The most obvious difference, already mentioned, relates to the purpose of two kinds of writing. Expository books try to convey knowledge about experiences that the reader has had or could have. Imaginative ones try to communicate as experience itself, one the reader can have or share only by reading, and if they succeed, they give the reader something to be enjoyed because they're diverse intentions. The two sorts of work appeal differently. Anyway, my eye is itching, so I should, and time is going. But I may come back to this. I may read this chapter and then paraphrase it for you rather than actually having to read it. But it seems that this book that our friend Neil gave me, who's talking about how to read a book, is really not aimed at fiction. Because this chapter is very titchy, and I suppose they had to include it. But it's, 412 pages.
It's got even pages too.
Yeah, it might have some even pages. And it's got so let's have a look at the index then, because it actually says study the index of the book to see if the book is for you. But it's got a load of old nonsense in here. Actively an art of reading, the levels of reading, the first level of reading, the second level of reading. It says how be a demanding reader, pigeonhole a little bit, x-ray book, coming to terms with the author, determining the author's message, criticising a book, aids to reading, how to read practical books, how to read imaginatively. Well, that's what we're on, reading stories, reading history. That might be interesting. How to read philosophy, blah, blah, blah. So, but it's like, it obviously waffles a bit, because there's 400 odd pages of this on how to read a book. Anyway, I shall leave it there, ladies and gentlemen. I just thought that might be interesting. He lent it to me very kindly, because he was telling me about it. He came round yesterday with some wood, some kindling wood. And he said, I've got this book called How to Read a Book. And I said, oh, yeah. Do you need to read the book to be able to read the book on how to read a book? And he didn't really find that funny. He said, no, it's not that. It tells you a bit more about how to read. Yeah. I said, I've seen a YouTube video on the same sort of subject, and they, you know, how to study, how to get information out of it. And of course, you know, when you read a book, you do read it at different levels, depending on your interest. Sometimes you're just sort of, like you do with a documentary, sort of cursory interest. It's sort of, oh, yeah, that'd be interesting. If it really takes you by the passion, you know, that's another thing. And then you absorb it, you absorb information. But if you have to study a book, and I would imagine a book like that really is aimed at students, really, who are having to read for university purposes. And so there'll be books they're not particularly interested in, but they have to read them. They have to pull out the facts. And there'll be all sorts of stuff about, you know, pull it out, reread the paragraph, write it down, you know, write up notes on the paragraph, you know, underline things, making references, all this sort of stuff. I mean, I don't do that. I do that if I'm doing research, but I think if you're doing research or you're trying to do a university course, it's a completely different thing than reading for pleasure. And my Biggleswick story will be reading for pleasure. We'll have some things which will challenge people and they'll go, oh, I don't know about that's true. But really and truly, they're not meant to be studying it. Somebody said to me, a friend of mine said to me, he said, oh, but your book will be a workbook for the truth movement. I said, no, it won't be. It's not that. But if anything, it's like peering through the keyhole and seeing something and thinking, oh, I wonder if that's true. And then you have to go off and do your own journey. I may leave some links in the back with I'd refer to web pages where further information can be found, should they want to. Just a short smattering, nothing profound. I don't want it to be profound. Anyway, thank you very much. I will catch up with you soon, and take care, look after yourself. Bye for now.